Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Justin Williams. Joining us today is Zainab Kalich, former sociology professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, film director, and current owner and chef of recently reopened Turkish Delight. We're going to be discussing her relationships with food and culture here in Alaska and how each facet of her life has been a platform for her story to be here in Alaska, preparing and cooking some of the best cuisine Anchorage has to offer. So good to see you. Zainab Kalich, you are the owner of Turkish Delight. And as a sociology major, I owe that to you. So your time in Turkey, being born and raised there, for someone, or maybe for our audience who's maybe never been out of Alaska, maybe never been out of the country, what was Turkey like? And what made you want to, or caused you, what was, if you're comfortable to talk about it, what caused you to move?
I mean, I had a really happy childhood. I have a very funny family. We love to laugh together. I mean, we didn't have a lot of material resources, but I didn't notice it, honestly. I didn't really have like a comparative point. Everybody seemed like equally kind of lower middle class-ish. You know, despite all of those things, I just remember a lot of laughter. My father was in the military, so we obviously moved quite a bit, but it also meant that we had some resources through the military. There were always kids my age around, so it always felt like we were playing like nonstop. So it was fun. And then, you know, growing up in urban Turkey, there are like too many young people and a lot of competition. So like schooling is very important. There's constant exams and, you know, constant comparisons with how the other kid did. But I excelled at school and I enjoyed it. It didn't really bother me as much, maybe. So I just remember good things. You know, we had obviously access to free healthcare, free education. You know, my parents had three kids. There's no way in a big city that they could have afforded to pay for three kids' education. So that was amazing that I went to one of the best colleges in Turkey. I didn't pay a dime. On top of it, the government gave me pocket money so that my parents didn't have to spend so much money, you know, for other kinds of things. So all of those things were wonderful. But the interesting thing is, it wasn't that I was unhappy in Turkey that pushed me to sort of seek out other places. I was just curious. I was always curious. I was like, how do people live there? You know, watching American movies, I've always wondered. It had a pull on me. And I had zero network. I didn't know anyone who lived outside of the country. I mean, nobody in my family has been even on a plane, you know. And first time I went to England as an au pair for a summer. But, you know, and my mom always says, why? Why do you have this desire to be away from us? It's not that I want to be away from them. I miss them a lot. But I'm just like really curious about other places and other people. And so I was the first one to leave. And, you know, there was something about it. I just wanted to come and try.
Mm-hmm. And you've done that.
Yes.
Here you are. Is that kind of, I mean, at the forefront, I feel like, of the current chapter in your life is the culinary world. I know that that has been a part of who you are for a pretty long time. But now you're the owner of a restaurant here in Anchorage, Alaska, bringing, I feel, flavors from your home country, from your childhood. And is that the basis of your film?
Not exactly. It has elements of it. My documentary was really sort of a combination of things that I was experiencing. And as a researcher, that's always what I've done. I always research things that I was curious about personally, not necessarily what was the in thing at the time. Like I remember my mentor saying when 9/11 happened, he said, drop everything you're doing. Switch, look at Islam, and you'll find a job immediately. And I was like, not interested. You know, I just want to, I'm kind of stubborn and selfish in the way that I just want to answer my own questions, which is why I really didn't like working at research institutes where you were given the question to study. So I prefer to just pick my own battles. But, you know, part of it was I was curious if what comes to the table is ultimately about your ethnic or religious belonging or national belonging or your social class. You know, what was the thing that really sort of changed what was on the table? And of course, as an immigrant myself, I always think about sort of is my obsession with Turkish food is partly because I'm not there. Like, right. If I stayed in Turkey, would I be this into food? I mean, I remember as young as 8, 9, always like sort of telling my mom, I want to make the dessert for the bayram and things like that. So I definitely had interest, but it wasn't like, you know, like you hear from big chefs and they're like, I was cooking with my grandmother when I was 3. Like, I don't necessarily have stories like that where I decided this is what I wanted to do. But it was always part of my thing. This is, I think it as cliche as it is definitely my love language. If I cook for you, that means I like you, you know, for certain. So, and I thought, if I was to go ask these questions in Turkey, would it be similar or would it be different? Because going back to Istanbul is a city of, you know, 15, 17 million people. It has people from everywhere, right? So they may not have immigrated across the borders into a different country, but they have immigrated kind of, you know, from Eastern Turkey to Istanbul, to this huge, you know, with the legendary Ottoman Empire background, you know, and it's so urban, but yet also traditional. And there's just so many interesting things happening there. I thought, do those people feel similarly about their foods as I do? Because I feel like maybe because I'm in such a non-Turkish food landscape that maybe my Turkishness sort of gets sharpened. What if it was sort of regional, right? Like, I mean, Eastern Turkey, do they feel the same way about when they go to Istanbul? So I was just curious about those things. I didn't know if it was or wasn't. So I thought, well, heck, I'll go ask and see what comes out of it.
Yeah.
That's how it started.
And your documentary is called Tales of Istanbul.
Tables of Istanbul.
Tables, yes, not tales. Yeah. Tables of
Tables
Istanbul.
Tables of Istanbul, yes. Exactly.
Awesome. Yeah. Where can audiences find that?
So I actually had it in Vimeo as a, like a password protected copy, and I'm going to put it on our restaurant webpage for as free. So if people are curious, they can go watch and sort of like have a little bit of understanding maybe in terms of the background of our restaurant and mm-hmm. our desire to open it as well.
So curiosity is kind of the core of what leads you to act. I feel curiosity, the unknown. One of the reasons why I love travel so much is because a lot of the time I don't know what's out there. Do you feel any type of pressure to appease a community that maybe doesn't understand the culture of your food or anything really about your food? Or does that sort of excite you to kind of introduce people around you to the food that you grew up with?
Yeah, it definitely excites us. I mean, that is really the reason my brother and I wanted to start this. And, you know, many people can imagine how hard it is to run a food business. It's very hard to please people on a consistent basis. It's like a never-ending thing. In fact, my brother was saying to me within the first week, he said, it is the hardest money I have ever earned. Hardest by, you know, by none in terms of comparison. So it is truly out of passion that we wanted to do it. And we wanted to share sort of our vision for Turkish cuisine. I mean, we're not trained chefs or anything, but we do have a lot of passion. And I certainly have a lot of training under my belt. I mean, I'm 53 years old, so I've taken probably at least 200 hours of culinary classes. I mean, on top of, you know, reading and like trying recipes over and over and over again. So we have really put in the time. So we're pretty strong home cooks. And there is a sort of a void in terms of that profile of cuisine in town. Like, we are a very diverse community here in Alaska. And yeah. There is really, I mean, we have wonderful food from around the world. But funny enough, from that Middle Eastern kind of Asia Minor, you don't really have, like, we don't have, I don't know, not that I know of, but other than a few Greek American restaurants, we don't really have like Israeli food. We don't really have Syrian food. We don't have like Iranian restaurants. You know what I mean? So that kind of profile is missing. And I think that is part of the appeal probably for people because it's different. And I think that overall Alaskans are open-minded and curious. But I do find myself sometimes when I had to be the front of the house, I would explain to people what's exciting about the menu. And I can see half the people get super excited and they're like, oh my God, we just want to eat what you want to eat. Bring that, you know, so that they can kind of see why I think it's amazing. But then there are other people that are like, no, I want hummus followed by falafel. And I'm like, okay, well, they're kind of the same thing. It's a lot of chickpeas. But,
yeah,
you know, and so I can see that like maybe some people, they just know something and they just want what they know.
Of course.
And of course, you know, the bossy part of me is like, but don't you want to try something different?
Right.
And the funny thing is, I didn't even grow up with hummus or falafel. I mean, if it was my choice, I would take them off the menu. Yeah. Because I wanted to sort of present a version of Turkey that I know of. You know, like my mother is from the Black Sea region, so I wanted to have like Black Sea dishes. And my dad is from down from south, from Marash, and I wanted to have some of those dishes. And then we grew up urban, you know, some of those dishes. But I know if I did that, there would be like, you know, people probably picketing in front of the restaurant, so we can't. But, you know, I do find it fascinating. And sometimes I'll like push a little bit, and then I'll see some people will be like, I just want what I want, you know? And I'm like, yes, Zeynep, stop controlling people. They want to eat what they want to eat, and that is fine.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the beauty, too, of the culinary culture here, the food culture here, is that people like what they like. And so when you tell me that we're missing an entire Middle Eastern region, an entire palette of delicious foods with your restaurant, do you just kind of want to run the restaurant and just kind of slide under the radar? Or is there a bigger hope, a bigger change that you hope to instill in the people of Anchorage?
I mean, we have definitely a bigger vision, but ultimately it's a new venture for us. I mean, my brother is an entrepreneur and he feels quite comfortable in that space. And honestly, I wouldn't have done this if it wasn't for him, right? I mean, it would be too scary for me. But we wanted to at least start and see how people respond to it. The current space we're in, people love it because it's the neighborhood restaurant. People walk to it, bike to it, which is really amazing. But it's very small kitchen. Yeah. Like that kitchen, like I would rather make our own, you know, flatbreads and things like that when we're doing sandwiches. But it's just simply impossible. I mean, it's already, we're kind of on top of each other. There's very little prep space. Baking is like very limited. And I love baking. So, you know, that space, this is sort of like how much we can stretch the menu at that space. But we have a much larger vision. Like I wish we can have our own, you know, kind of like the pizza oven, you know, the Turkish version of it, to make all the pides and the flatbreads. And then I would love to have a Turkish patisserie, you know, like coffee shop where the drinks are with Turkish coffee, Turkish drinks like the wild orchid root and things like that. I just don't want to do what other people do. Other people do wonderful things and they do great things, right?
So you want to break conformity in the restaurant culture and maybe to the consumer as well. You want to help establish an open-mindedness of your version of Turkey, because not everyone there, not every immigrant has the same childhood and grew up with the same, like you said, you didn't have a lot of those experiences where you're just in the kitchen at 3-4 years old cooking with your grandmother. So your experiences are a little bit different than, you know, the person who may be an immigrant, maybe even from, you know, Turkey or wherever, but their experiences are different. And so if you two had a discussion over coffee, over tea, and decided to create two different restaurants with the same food in mind, you would still want it to be drastically different.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess, and you know this from our classes for race and ethnicity, et cetera, there is a lot of sort of racial, you know, undertones to what we do. You know, ethnic eateries are sort of the hype right now. People are interested and people are increasingly more interested in sort of like more, you know, hole in the wall, you know, dive kind of a place. And I think there are some maybe power dynamics there as well. Also seeing immigrants that are sort of a, you know, like everything is so low level that people also kind of feel comfortable going to that because they feel like they're just coming down to somebody else's level to try something. And I don't think these are necessarily conscious. Some of it could be subconscious. So I'm very mindful of all those things. I'm very aware of the sort of the catch-22 that the ethnic feeder might find themselves in, right? This is like what you want to make money, right? I mean, like, there are so many first generation immigrants who come and maybe they do not have the language skills. Maybe they have professional credentials, but it doesn't transfer here, right? So what is the easiest place that they can sort of break in and create a niche for themselves is usually food, right? Because they're not questioned. People just assume, oh, you're from Zambia, you must know Zambian food really well. Well, not everybody cooks really well, you know, just because they're from there. But that's one area where their authenticity is not questioned and actually desired. And so I feel that many first-generation immigrants sometimes break into food business, not necessarily because it's their passion or they really want to, you know, share a particular version of it, but it's because the easiest thing that they can capitalize on, right? And of course, when people with very limited resources go into it, they don't want to invest anything in it. They just want to get money from it. So then the ambiance, maybe, other than a few tchotchkes, you know, they don't want to spend money in making the space a certain way. These are all understandable, you know, economically it makes perfect sense. And so for us, it's not the case. Like, I want the space to inspire something. I don't necessarily, there's a lot of Turkish things in the space we've created, but it's probably not the most cliche. I'm not going to put a fez somewhere. You know what I mean? And it's fine when other people do it, but I'm just saying that's not who I am as a Turkish American immigrant. And that's not the version of Turkey I can share because that's not the version of Turkey I grew up with. So there are all these nuances in terms of who the ethnic entrepreneur is. What is it that they're trying to get from that? You know, what they're trying to capitalize on. I'm very aware of all those. And then I'm very aware of, like, the people coming in and what they want to find and what they want to feel in that space. Yes, it's about me. Mm-hmm. But if people don't see the value in it, they don't want it, they don't want to buy it, then what's the point?
Do you believe ultimately that that makes you an effective chef because you know what they expect? Or are you more, like you said earlier, concerned with bringing your authentic vision?
Yeah, it's a difficult dance. But I did tell my brother from the very beginning that there were certain things that were just no-no to me. Like, I couldn't just, whether it challenged my notion of ethics or my, like, this is not the way I want to present myself. There are certain things that I just won't do, even if it is financially viable. And he's been very nice about it because he may not care about it, but he just says, okay, you care. So we'll, you know, we'll make do. But I understand that you can't do it 100% of the time, right? I mean, like, so you have to make concessions on the menu and then in terms of how you present it. But I guess I've been in the US for 30 years. So I don't really feel like I have to make myself appeal to you. You know what I mean? I feel like I am from here. I lived in the US longer than I've lived in Turkey. So I don't have this need to be accepted or that I don't have the need to explain myself if somebody acts like, you know, whether because of my accent or, you know, whether what they see in my look, then maybe they don't think I belong here. But it's not like a brand new immigrant, you know, fresh off the boat. It's a completely different mentality. You know, when I first came, I was just so open because I didn't know anyone, right? I mean, I just wanted to make friends, be likable. And many things I couldn't read. I couldn't read the racial kind of undertones because, you know, that's not where I was coming from. Where I was coming from, I was the majority, so I never had to pay attention to it. So that maybe makes us a little different in the sense that I don't feel the need to just bend over backwards just because you're my customer. I mean, I'm very nice. I'll do anything to make you happy. But if I think that there is like some sort of a weird expectation that I am below you and therefore I must serve you, you know, I love that little thing from a movie where he says, we serve them, but we're not their servants. You know, serving is really an act of kindness.
This is Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm Justin Williams. For just tuning in, I'm here with Zeynep Kılıç, former UAA sociology professor and current owner of local restaurant Turkish Delight.
We've been discussing her relationships with the cuisine she was raised with and what it means for her to own a local restaurant as both an immigrant and as someone who's been in America longer than her homeland of Turkey. Hold tight, we'll be back. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm Justin Williams. If you're just tuning in, I'm here with Zeynep Kılıç, former UAA sociology professor and current owner of local restaurant Turkish Delight. We're going to be talking about how the sociology of race plays into the food she makes, her approach to sharing food, and her favorite dishes.
So as far as your childhood, your culinary experience, your academia, you know, your status as an immigrant, as a successful businesswoman, what is home for you?
I mean, home to me is where you belong and it's never questioned. Should you be there or should you not be there? And then on a more personal level, home to me is very social. I mean, I love being home by myself with my cat and Netflix, but in general, what home represents to me is around the table, a lot of laughter, deep conversations. It's always social. And I think that's partly why I moved up to Alaska, even though Alaska wasn't ever in my radar, because my brother lived here. And I just thought, he's my only family in the U.S., and I don't want to be away from him. Sure. You know, I want to be able to just have dinners together. I want to be able to know his kids closely. And then, you know, I met my husband here and got married, and through him, I have three kids and three grandchildren. So I love that, you know, the big, big family gathering, or the family that you make with your friends, you know. But for me, if I'm by myself, I rarely cook. To me, you know, home is where food is and people, you know, your people, whether they are blood relations or otherwise, but, and they don't question why you're there.
Right.
You belong.
You belong.
Yeah.
Home is where food is. That needs to go on a t-shirt or a bumper sticker or something. I'll credit you. You'll get a cut. So what is your favorite food in the restaurant, outside of the restaurant, anything you've had at home, Arizona, Jersey, wherever, like, what is that one dish that you just love to make or can't get out of your brain?
I don't have favorites. I love food too much to be able to pick one or two things. I love a million things.
Yeah.
And it changes over time, or the context matters a lot.
Yes.
Like if I am in Turkey, it's summer, we're by the beach and we're going out with my buddies. Ooh, then I want to go to this like seafood restaurant, mm-hmm, by the water. And there's like 72 kinds of mezes, appetizers. Mm-hmm. And they keep coming, right? First, they start with the cold, and they bring the warm ones. They bring the grilled fish, and then they bring the fruit and the melon and the cheese. And the I love that. Like, I love, instead of eating a big plate of something, I love to have like 3-4 different things, but little. Like, it'll just make you feel like, if there was one more bite of that, like, I would go for it. So I love to eat like that rather than being full on one particular profile. Sure. I just like trying things different. And then I'm not a big meat person in general. And I know Americans love their protein. Mm-hmm. So I get my husband. I mean, we get off from the dining table and I go for something sweet and he goes for jerky. I'm like, okay. less competition for me for dessert. So that's okay. Those kinds of things. And as you can see, I still said two things that involved other people. You know, that we are actually enjoying it together. It's almost like an event, not just something that you, because you're hungry and you have to fill your belly. It's very intentional. You set aside time for it. You always sort of gather people you love around the table, you know? So it's not just acquaintances, like people you really like, you know, have belly laughs with or have very deep conversations with. And those are the kinds of things that I love to eat. So if that's the environment, I'll find something, you know, something to eat probably. But in general, I mean, and my physique would attest to this, I'm more of a carb girl. So,
yeah. Well, that answers that for sure. It's a very difficult thing to decide what your favorite thing is. I mean, some things just stick with you, you know, like your favorite person or your favorite film or your favorite joke or your favorite city or farmland or wherever, you know. Some things stick with you and other things don't. And for the food, that's a tough one. I think it's a tough one for a lot of Alaskans because we are exposed to so many wondrous things to try all the time. Even the repetitive stuff that we were talking about earlier. A lot of people will take a lot of the same things and do it drastically differently. This restaurant does burgers and fries radically different than these people do burgers and fries, you know. We'll call them different things, you know. And I just think it's so fun reflecting on these sorts of things because everybody's palate is a little bit different. Our brains are different. The way that we relate to, you know, our, you know, I don't know, our respective neighborhoods, I guess. So just like who we determine are, you know, is our family based off of our friends, based off of our, you know, our business network and stuff like that. The people that we belly laugh with, you know, who we want to share these things with. That will change what someone wants to eat in a moment's notice, you know. And I think that's really fascinating too. I want to ask you, Turkish Delight, what's happening there? You've been there for 3 months. You took it over. What can the city of Anchorage and all of Alaska expect from Turkish Delight in the future?
Well, we really strive to make everything better. Obviously, it's a learning curve. But I want people to know that it's not for lack of trying. I mean, if you are failing at any moment, whether it's the service or the plating or whatever, we're doing our best and we're definitely striving to be better every day. And it's really out of our desire to sort of present our, you know, beautiful rosy version of Turkey. And we want to share it with them. And we're working on our menu because, you know, you have to just start from somewhere and see how people respond to it. And we're going to have a winter menu. So we're going to change things up a little bit. And then, as I said, we would love to work towards having brunches. And I think that would probably be very sought after, I would imagine. And as I said, you know, there are some challenges in the kitchen in terms of how small it is. So for us to really, there are many things we want to do. We just can't do them in the existing setup. And then, you know, go from there. I mean, you know me, I'm always an academic at heart. So I would love to have like maybe special nights where it's a theme. I don't know. I mean, I haven't gotten there, but like maybe it's food and fear, food and love, you know, food and memory. Or it could be built around a particularly significant ingredient, you know, like wheat. You know, things like that. Obviously, I don't have enough, like, you know, culinary formation to, like, do an amazing thing. But, you know, one can dream and one can work towards it. Yes. I can maybe learn. Who knows? Maybe I have some chef friends in Turkey. Maybe they will come over. Maybe we'll collaborate for an event like that. I would love to do interactive kinds of things where there's a little bit of education, you know, when a dish comes out, maybe there's like a little explanation and then maybe we ask people to write something down, kind of like what the museum events and Seed Lab do quite a bit, like that these little cue cards and, or like having a butcher block paper where people draw things about like what that food is sort of like initiating for them. You know, I would love to do stuff like that. I would love to talk to people about their experience of food. I remember years and years ago, I took a friend of mine to Turkey and it was, I think, November, which is not like the touristic season. And we went to my parents' summer house on the coast. And usually in November, it's cold that, you know, they don't really stay there. They go to their place in Izmir. But anyways, we stayed there. And from that whole thing, the thing that she remembered was that after dinner, my mom took a bowl of fruit and she peeled every one of them. She cut them up, put them on a plate, put a fork and gave it to her. And she thought, as an adult, she said, nobody has ever like peeled an orange for me to eat. They may give me an orange to eat. But she thought that that was like such an act of kindness. But it was something so ubiquitous in my experience that that's what moms do. Like you're watching TV as a family and there'll be a bowl of fruit and she'll after dinner and she'll do that. And sometimes actually she'll just reach out with her hand with like one single piece of apple and shove it in your mouth. So to me, it was like, that's the thing that stands in her memory as like extreme kindness. And because she felt like she babied her, she felt like she was like what you do to a child. And that felt nourishing to her. You know, that kind of stuff is like super interesting to me. Because if she didn't share it or if I didn't ask it, I would have never known that. And I love to hear, this is my experience with this food. But that doesn't mean when you eat it, you're going to feel that. So I'm super curious what you make of it. Like I make this ice cream and I'm like super curious. Will they hate it? Because texturally it's different. And the aroma is different. You know, so when they say, oh, it was this, it was that, it's things that I couldn't come up with. So I love to do stuff like that and collect those, maybe put them on the website, you know, when I have time before I die. But, you know, so sky's the limit. I mean, you have to really keep dreaming, keep thinking, and some of them will become reality. Maybe others won't, but I hope to get there.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I love that feedback is such a intriguing part of like, you know, you're just kind of like collecting data, but it's more than just like, you know, ones and zeros. You're collecting like the emotions of people as well when they're writing about your food and talking about your food. So if someone wants to give you feedback or just reach out to you, where would they find you?
I mean, we do have an Instagram page and we have a website and we also have a Facebook page. So people usually like DM us there. Obviously, people leave reviews on Google and Yelp, et cetera. And this is another thing I would love to research. I mean, I'm so fascinated by the notion of reviewing food. And this is something you do. And I'm really curious about who these people are because people who love what's going on usually will tell to your face. Mm-hmm. They'll just come and say, oh, my God, it was so good. Thank you so much. Or will DM us. But they're not the ones running to Google to write something. People who somehow hate something or their experience, they're the ones usually who shout it off the rooftops. And as a professor, I'm very used to this, right? I mean, that's what happens. And it has really made me think deeply about, you know, we think about everybody can become a content producer on the internet, and that's a democratizing thing. And that's a wonderful thing, right? I mean, we bypass the gatekeepers, the editors, and blah, 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 the establishment. But obviously my overworked small business owner, you know, I haven't slept in months person feels emotional reading something like that. But my researcher self is super curious. Like, what is their motivation? Is their motivation to really give constructive criticism because they want you to do better? Are they really trying to help people who are trying to pick a place and they want them to, you know, avoid the pitfalls that they have, you know, succumbed to? What is their motivation truly? Is it about ego? And of course, we love to hear from people who enjoyed it. You know, thank you so much for taking the time to share it, whether that's on Google or Yelp or wherever else they want to write about or on the Facebook page. We, you know, it makes us feel like it was worth it. You know, when I fall into bed at 2 a.m. and I just think, you know, questioning my life choices, like, what was I thinking? And I just see this thing pop up and says, you know, Justin just left a 5-star review. And they said, it was honestly the best thing I've eaten in a long time. And thank you so much for your, you know, beautiful service or whatever. It just makes us so happy. Then I go to the servers and say, hey, people are loving what you're doing. Thank you so much. So then it just sort of takes away some of our tired feeling. Like right. It just feels like we want to come back stronger the next day. And most people are quite gracious. So we really want to thank our Anchorage community. They've been quite supportive.
Well, thank you for spending your time with me here. This has been a phenomenal just exchange of emotions and information. And I feel like I know you so much more now. So just thank you so much for spending your time with us here. Really appreciate it, Zaina.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm honored.
That was Zeynep Kılıç of Turkish Delight. We had the opportunity to talk about the culture that she brings to her restaurant and what it means to bring home wherever she is through the food that she makes. We'll have links and more info on the Hometown Alaska page at alaskapublic.org. Do you have an idea for a show? Go ahead and send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Justin Williams. This is Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
Every other Monday night, a long-standing Thai restaurant in Anchorage transforms into a makeshift arcade. People flock to Thai Kitchen to compete in video game tournaments. As Alaska Public Media's Dev Hardiker reports, it's a chance for them to make a new friend or a new rival.
Let's go!
A crowd forms in the closed Thai restaurant, where people are locked in tense virtual one-on-one fights. Chairs are stacked up against the back wall. Computer monitors occupy the restaurant's tables. Contestants hammer on the buttons of their arcade controllers. It's Monday Night Combat, a fighting video game tournament that happens every other week in Anchorage's Thai Kitchen. Today, they're playing Street Fighter. The event is organized by Banky Kichponich, a lifelong Anchorage resident whose family has run the restaurant for 37 years. He's been involved in competitive fighting games since he was a kid.
I was 13, so I'm 30 now. I've been doing it for 17 years.
The competitions are a chance for Kichponich and his friends, and anyone who might walk in the door, to sharpen their skills and meet other like-minded people. Competitors mill around between matches, talking strategy and poking fun at each other. It's one of few remaining spaces in the city where people can play video games face-to-face. That used to be the only way to do it, but Kichponich says arcades started disappearing when online gaming took off in the early 2000s. Now, he says, most people just play over the internet.
People just prefer to sit in their home, you know, comfortably. They don't have to go anywhere. Just as easy to play with friends. I totally see the appeal, you know?
But Kichponich says playing in person has an entirely different appeal.
There's definitely a different vibe to offline events. People get really hype just watching, you know? We're like, we'll egg each other on, talk some crap to each other.
He first started organizing monthly competitions in the neighboring frozen yogurt store in 2017, but the pandemic brought those to a halt.
Since COVID just pretty much like shut down all the offline events, we didn't have anything for a really long time, right? And people were just missing the offline competition.
The pandemic also impacted his family's restaurant. Thai Kitchen has exclusively done takeout orders since May 2020 and started closing on Mondays. Kichponich saw this as the perfect opportunity to relaunch the gaming tournaments.
When I found out that, hey, we're going to be closing once a week finally, I was like, is it cool if I throw some video game tournaments here? Because there's nowhere else in town I can really do that. They're like, yeah, of course, you know, just like clean up after yourself. That's basically it, you know.
He started Monday Night Combat in June 2021.
Oh, jab check and Zanstar.
Matches are live streamed on Twitch with two people doing commentary for the audience.
Oh, straight to the left three. He wants the damage. He wants that early lead.
That's Rafael Borromeo, a longtime commentator and competitor. He's been part of the scene for 14 years. He says the atmosphere of offline tournaments can't be beat.
You ever watch a fighting game on a big screen, big crowd, everyone's yelling? It's almost like a sporting event. It's kind of like watching a UFC fight, but not exactly the same, obviously. But, you know, it's just like the energy, the camaraderie, the, you know, the competitiveness. It always brings me back.
Over the years, Anchorage's competitive fighting game scene has essentially become one tight-knit group of friends, with a couple new faces every tournament. Kichponich says all kinds of people show up. Some are completely new to fighting games, and some have been playing them competitively for their entire lives.
Instead of just, like, teams that are invited to play, it's basically an open bracket. So, you know, Joe Schmo from down the street can come over, play against Michael Jordan.
It costs $2 to come play, and another $5 to enter a tournament bracket. The winners get a cut of the earnings. At the most recent event, 20 people entered, and first place went home with $50. Kichponich says it's usually a pretty small cash prize. People really just compete because they love to compete.
It's more of a passion thing, you know, and you get a free lunch if you win, basically. So, yeah.
At the end of the night, the tables are cleared of monitors. On Tuesday, Thai Kitchen opens for lunch, as if nothing ever happened. In Anchorage, I'm Dev Hardiker.
Coming up next, State of Art.
From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, we'll hear all about Galway Days Irish Festival. It's happening on Saturday, August 4th at Town Square Park. There'll be music, dancing, workshops, food, and more. I'm joined by Irish Club of Alaska President Don Berg to find out more.
Galway Days Irish Festival is the Irish Club of Alaska's way of sharing with the community all things that are, you know, celebrating Irish culture and traditions and all things Irish Alaskan, really.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, there does seem to be like it's just a one day festival, but there's a lot going on. So, I mean, could you kind of break down some of the highlights of what people could experience at the festival?
Sure. We're going to have a main stage, which will be running from 11 to 6 p.m. with a variety of local and visiting acts. So that will be everything from dancing, like the Irish Dance Academy of Alaska, to singing. I think we have a juggler and a storyteller. So we'll have a little bit of everything to appeal. And then we have a workshop tent where we have kind of short workshops, 20 to 30 minute workshops that people can come and learn about a variety of topics, history, song, different instruments. We have a children's tent with all kinds of activities throughout the day to introduce children to Irish songs and culture in a variety of ways through coloring projects and, you know, learning how to play the whistle. And then we have, of course, things like a beer garden and food vendors. So we're just going to have all kinds of things.
I see that there's going to be an evening concert associated with this. Is this a new development or is this something that you folks have been doing for a little while?
We have done an evening concert in the past. Last year, it being our first year back to a live format, we just didn't really have the time and the energy to kind of get all that together. This year, we have Amelia Hogan, who she came and participated with us in a variety of Zoom events that we did as the Irish Club of Alaska. She also participated with the Celtic Community of Alaska on several occasions via Zoom and also the Alaskan Scottish Club. So she's been both here in person last summer, and she sang and did some workshops for us. And this year, she just released an album called Taking Flight, and she's kind of on tour, so she's bringing a couple musicians with her, and she's going to be doing some of the material from her album, as well as some of the traditional and contemporary Irish songs that she knows. She does a little bit of singing in Gaelic and a little bit of the Sean Nose style, which is a little bit different of a style. She's going to apparently bring her Shruti box and
What is a Shruti box?
Musician friend. A Shruti box is kind of, it's a drone instrument, and it just gives you a drone tone that you can kind of fan. So it's like playing an accordion without all the keys, you know, just the drone part. The people that she's bringing with her from the San Francisco Bay Area, Autumn Rhodes and Jimmy Murphy, will add a lot of energy and a lot of variety to the concert that we'll be having at the 49th State Brewing Company in their Heritage Theater. They're one of our major sponsors this year, and so they've generously made that possible. So we're quite excited. People can get those tickets online at our website, irishalaska.org, or they can come by the festival and pick up their tickets during the day or at the door.
So, you know, you mentioned, or you have mentioned that, you know, the Irish Club of Alaska is kind of one of the big organizers of this event. Could you kind of talk about what you do and then how people can get involved?
Sure. Well, we like to put on a variety of events and encourage people to experience Irish culture in a variety of ways. We've been hosting monthly song circles and some open mics. And, you know, we've always worked pretty closely with the local Celtic community in a variety of ways, whether it was the dance groups or the Scottish Club. But we're really lucky that we also have support from places like the Atwood Foundation and the Consulate General in San Francisco to help, you know, really bring some of these things. And that doesn't matter whether it's, you know, a little lecture about, you know, feminism in Ireland or about an Irish author. You know, we're trying to make it so that there's a little something for everyone. We've had a little comedy. We've had a little storytelling. This year, we'll also have a couple of selfie stations of photos that were taken in Ireland by some of our members. So we'll, you know, we're just encouraging people to come out and have a fun and just experience a little bit of Ireland and Irish culture on their own terms, you know, and to share with us. Sometimes we've had participatory things where people can come and do their, you know, what they do. And sometimes we're showcasing our members and the people who want to, you know, share basically what they know.
Yeah. What's a good way to stay up to date with everything that you've got going on, you know, beyond just the festival?
Right. So we have our website, which is irishalaska.org. We also have a Facebook page that we're quite active on. I am the one who's sharing a lot of different things from different Irish sites and photography places. And but we're also right now featuring and doing spotlights for a lot of our different vendors and workshop providers and performers. So we'll be letting people know some of the things that will be going on at the festival. We also like to share information about other, you know, upcoming things that we know of that are happening. We are always looking for people who are interested in volunteering, whether it's, you know, to come as a baker or to come help with one of the different performances. We definitely have a lot of needs, whether it's, you know, somebody who's more interested in doing IT or marketing or, you know, graphic design, because these are always things that it's a little, you know, it's a very time consuming thing. And if you're not retired, it takes a lot to, you know, just even be a 501c3 charitable organization and put on a couple of different events a year. We will be having some other events throughout the year. We support other events like Samhain and Celtic Spring Festival with, you know, attending and bringing our booth or our information. We also put on the Irish Holiday Market, which was a first last year, which will be at the Nave on December 10th this year. And we kind of, that's just more of a little small, you know, holiday market with vendors and bake sale and, you know, a white elephant and music and just kind of a little, you know, kind of like that old community hall type feel, you know, bringing together different culture and different Celtic vendors. We also do a production in the spring, usually in March, called Afternoon in Ireland. So we usually have a theme, and some years it might be something like fairies, or we definitely have had different themes. Last year it was Shula Roon, Laments of War and Prayers for Peace. So it was a lot of the different songs that had to do with war and anti-war sentiment particularly. So we have all these different productions. We'd like to stay connected with the rest of the world with our Zoom productions. We haven't done as many of those this winter, but we made a lot of friends all across the world. And so, you know, we were able to have singers and storytellers from Ireland and all across the United States and even Australia come and participate in a variety of our functions. And that, so that was really, really great. And it would be nice to have both more volunteers to help make those things happen and more people who are just interested in those kinds of things, you know, to make them happen. A lot of times you just can't do everything with 6 or 8 people or 10, you know. but yeah, we're looking at trying to grow the club and find out what the community is interested in as far as Irish culture. Maybe it's music and dance, which, you know, is what the Irish Cultural Collective primarily does, is have kind of these little pop-up Kayleys where they teach dancing and play music. Or maybe there's more interest in other aspects of Irish culture. I put together an Irish butterfly thing for the Highland Games this year, just because it was something that kind of interested me. I ran across some great photos and a couple of interesting posters and thought, well, that could be a fun thing for the kids to learn about. Because it's not just a place of green beer and, you know, the Blarney Stone. It's a living, breathing culture with an ecology and a people that are, you know, changing and growing too. So there's a lot that we would like to preserve and celebrate and just share with the world.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the possibilities are endless and you're open to feedback and kind of it's a two-way street for kind of what you guys are wanting to put out.
Exactly. And we will obviously be focusing on this for the month of August, but I'm hoping that we will have a song circle later in August when we've all recovered. And maybe I'll decide what date that will be so we can advertise that before. I haven't quite figured that one out. And, we're hoping to bring something like our open mic series out to the Valley next in the month of September, if we can find somebody who can help us find a venue. And we'd like to take some things on the road if we can, invite other people to come and participate with us. We just would, you know, we're interested in growing and sharing and putting on quality productions that people can, you know, enjoy and have a little taste of all things Irish.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's about all I've got for you, but sure. I was wondering if you could leave listeners with a little traditional Irish phrase, if you could.
I'm not really good at speaking, but I do know a couple of children's songs, so I could sing part of a song called Be'e Naka Marach, which is basically a story about a little girl who's going to a fair and she's only 11 and her mom's telling her, you know, maybe when you're 13, you know, because she wants to go and buy ribbons and be admired by soldiers, which she is a bit young for that. And it kind of goes like this. It goes, Be nakamarak agon de unclar. Be nakamarak agon de unclar. Be nakamarak agon de unclar. Can why do we ni be may on?
That was my conversation with Dawn Berg, president of the Irish Club of Alaska. She was telling us about the Galway Days Irish Festival happening on August 4th at Town Square Park. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
All right, that's our show today. Thanks for tuning in to Hometown Alaska, and thank you to Zainab Khalid for sharing your story with us. You can find us on the Hometown Alaska page at alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Ammon Swenson produces the show. I'm your host, Justin Williams. See you again soon.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.